Tess Vigeland here from the Wall Street Journal's As We Work podcast. This season, we'll take you from that first job all the way to retirement and all the career moments along the way. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is your tech news briefing for Thursday, June 2nd. I'm Zoe Thomas for the Wall Street Journal. In our special series on the new space economy, we've talked about how work and manufacturing will be impacted, both in space and here on Earth. But who actually sets the rules governing how those jobs or businesses can be set up? And what regulations will they have to follow once they're in orbit or operating on the moon?
Many countries actually disagree on what companies like ours and what countries, nation states, should be able to do on other planetary bodies and should not be able to do.
Today, we're talking space law. The rules and norms that exist now and what governments and private businesses are doing to set up new ones. That's after the break.
Check out Amazon Remars at remars.amazonevents.com/WSJ to attend for just $199.
The high seas, international waters. Just off a country's coastline, national laws apply. Go a few miles further out, and territorial waters end. Beyond that line, there's an international treaty, the United Nations Law of the Sea, that sets the rules for acceptable behavior. But there's no single body in charge of open waters. And that's also true when you go not out, but up.
3, 2, and liftoff.
To outer space.
The comparison between outer space and the high seas is a very relevant one and very helpful to at least understand the basics, because both are geographical areas where by law it is impossible for a single state to call a part thereof its own.
Frans van der Dunk is a space lawyer and professor at the Nebraska College of Law. Sure, governments can make laws for what happens in their territory, when, where, and how rockets are launched, for example. But they can't force businesses or other entities to follow those laws in space. Out there, there is no one body writing or enforcing the rules.
The high seas are free for everyone, and so is outer space. So there is no, legally speaking, colonization of outer space possible, just as there never was colonization of the high seas possible.
That's one small step for man, one
When Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin planted the American flag on the moon,
they've got the flag up now, and you can.
It didn't make the moon U.S. territory because of an international agreement that was signed just 2 years before, called the Outer Space Treaty. The deal was struck during the Cold War, at the height of the space race between the U.S. and former Soviet Union. That agreement held that space belongs to everyone, all of humanity. And it set provisions for how to behave in space. For example, it stated that countries would be liable for any damage that their spacecrafts caused, and that the moon and other celestial bodies should be used only for peaceful purposes. The principles of the Outer Space Treaty were devised when few governments, let alone private companies, were actually able to send people into space. But over the years, that's changed. Here's van der Dunk again.
Well, it's clear that if space becomes too crowded, which is what we're talking about now, that gentlemen's agreements are no longer sufficient, and not everyone is a gentleman, of course.
Today, more countries are spacefaring, and private companies are sending up satellites, selling tickets to orbit, and establishing their own missions to the moon. That's testing the limits of these rules and revealing some gaping holes in international space law, according to experts. For example, who plays air traffic control in space? Who can extract natural resources and profit from them? And how should space be kept free of pollution? Let's start with space traffic. Von der Dunk says using maritime law as a guide starts to fall short here. At sea, ships approaching head-on pass on the port side, the left side. In space, figuring out who has the right of way is trickier.
Outer space is three-dimensional, it can be upside down, so left and right are very relative notions, so you have to think about much more in detail.
This issue was highlighted last year when China complained to the UN that it was forced to move its space station twice to avoid colliding with SpaceX Starlink satellites. That's an official for China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, accusing the U.S. of violating the Outer Space Treaty. At the time, SpaceX CEO Elon Musk denied his satellites were in the way. But SpaceX is sending up thousands of satellites to make up its internet-providing constellation, and that creates a lot more chances for collisions. Here's space lawyer Von der Dunk again.
There is no real traffic management regime which regulates that. By the way, that's one of the important things which are being developed right now, but we are really at the beginning of that.
There are rules in the event of collisions. According to the Outer Space Treaty, countries are responsible for damage they cause to other space objects, like another country's satellites or space station. They're also responsible for enforcing these rules for spacefaring entities like businesses that are based within their borders. So, if Starlink satellites had damaged the Chinese space station, the U.S. would be expected to hold SpaceX accountable. But there's a hitch. International law and space law, by extension, require both sides to agree on what actually happened.
If they both disagree about these things, there is no overarching, impartial judge or jury who can then say, okay, the United States was right, or Starlink was right, or vice versa, China is right, and this is the legal verdict, and let alone then actually enforce that.
Getting nations and businesses to agree to a set of rules gets even trickier when we start talking about using resources in space. Remember when we talked about future space jobs and moon miners? One thing we didn't discuss was, are companies even allowed to take those materials? You could argue if the moon, like the high seas, belongs to everyone, anyone should be permitted to take from it. If you can catch a fish in open waters, you can sell it. The US and some other countries think you can do the same with moon dirt. And to prove that, NASA wrote a check for a whopping 10 cents.
Here's a copy of the check.
That's Phil McAllister, NASA's Director of Commercial Spaceflight. He oversees the agency's partnerships with private businesses.
We have milestone payments, and the first payment was 10% of the overall value of the contract. And it was only a dollar, so we had to write a check for 10 cents.
The dollar is for moon dirt. It's the first check NASA ever cut to a company for a substance gathered in space. That company was Colorado-based space startup Lunar Outpost.
We are going out to be the first pioneers of the new space economy.
Lunar Outpost CEO Justin Cyrus and his team are planning to send multiple rovers to the moon at the end of the year and in 2023.
And we're going to prospect for resources and carry along scientific and technical payloads while we're on the moon. Lunar Outpost is providing folks access to different parts of the lunar surface through our robotic systems.
Those payloads are from private clients who want to do scientific research on the moon. The rovers will collect samples to bring back down, including the lunar soil the company is selling to NASA. But why is NASA buying this to begin with? The U.S. has been thinking about mining and selling materials from space for years. In 2015, Congress passed the Space Act. It permitted U.S. citizens to mine asteroids. But there were questions about whether it violated the principles of the Outer Space Treaty. So, a few years later, the U.S. developed the Artemis Accords of 2020. the Accords established at least some international agreement on the peaceful use of the moon and other celestial bodies, including the ability to mine. 19 countries, including the US, signed on, but some major space powers, like China and Russia, didn't. The US is using the Artemis Accords as a legal basis for its plan to buy resources mined on the moon, and hoping other nations will follow suit. Phil McAllister from NASA says the agency in particular wants companies to know that when they buy and sell space materials, there will be laws back on Earth governing those transactions. And that $1 moon dirt deal with Lunar Outpost, more than anything, it's about establishing economic norms.
We wanted to be able to establish that you can have economic transactions of lunar material, because we feel like that's very important for the economic expansion of, and eventual utilization of the moon, and potentially people living on the moon as well.
The U.S. can't unilaterally write space laws or force its interpretation of treaties on others. But McAllister says they want their transactions in space to be seen as legitimate.
We don't control space at NASA or even in the United States, but we do want to maintain our interests and make sure that we have freedom of operation, both for our national security and our civil space activities and our commercial space activities. Just like the Coast Guard helps with intersea commerce and ensuring that some U.S. maritime assets are maintained, obviously we have a similar interest in doing that in space.
But what does Lunar Outpost get out of the deal? Here's Justin Cyrus again.
We want to make sure we're at the table, and we want to make sure we're part of the conversation of how companies like ours and many companies for future generations are going to access, sell, and utilize these resources.
But remember, not all countries agree with the U.S. interpretation that resources can be taken from space and resold. After all, the Outer Space Treaty says that space resources should be for everyone. And some note that not every country has the ability to get to the moon, let alone mine there. Space lawyer Franz von der Dunk says countries that feel this way could act to make it difficult for companies mining those resources to sell them. For example, they could treat them like blood diamonds.
As illegal contraband, so if I get my hands on them, I'll take it, and I'm going to punish you, which means that those companies may, technically speaking, find a state which is in agreement to them, but it doesn't mean that much if they can't sell it to the rest of the world.
NASA says it's been working with the UN to promote and reap the benefits of space exploration. The agency added that it has deals with non-US companies, and it encourages other countries to sign on to the Artemis Accords. Getting international agreement on what rules should apply and how to apply them is one of the biggest hurdles for setting space law right now. In May, the UN set up an open-ended working group to start crafting regulations for low Earth orbit. And there are some pressing issues, like the threat of space debris. The rising commercial activity has already created pollution just outside Earth's atmosphere. Some international space agreements encourage countries to clean up after themselves, but without enforcement mechanisms. Here's von der Dunk again.
I call outer space often the global commons for a reason, because there's also something which says the tragedy of the commons, which means that everybody feels entitled to benefit from it, but nobody feels responsible for making sure that it remains useful and operable, or beautiful, if you will.
With each new launch, the problem only grows. In fact, it's already proven to be a real and pressing hazard. Tomorrow, on our final episode of our special space series, we'll dive into the problem of space junk and the efforts that are already being made, despite the lack of laws, to clean it up. Thanks for joining us for this episode of our special space series on Tech News Briefing. This episode was written and reported by myself and producer Julie Chang. Jess Fenton is our sound engineer. We had editorial support from David Freeman. Our supervising producer is Chris Zinsley. Our executive producer is Kateri Yoakum. And I'm Zoe Thomas for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
Tess Vigeland here from the Wall Street Journal's As We Work podcast. This season, we'll take you from that first job all the way to retirement and all the career moments along the way. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.